Hello, and welcome to Geek Orthodox. I'm Father Justin, geek from my youth. And in this last episode on the deaths of Arthur, this last podcast on it, I want to reflect on the significance of the death of Arthur for geek subculture, and really for me, as an individual and as a geek and as a Christian. The death of Arthur is hugely significant. It's hugely significant for, I think, geek subculture too, in an indirect way. I mean, it is, I would say, the Arthurian legend is kind of the urtext of English literature. It's kind of there in the background and becomes known even as the matter of Britain, ironically by the known by the French poets writing on Arthur. It's also really important in terms of being the background for the fathers of modern fantasy, C.S. Lewis and J.R.R. Tolkien, in a number of ways. Maybe I'll start there. Tolkien actually wrote an extended alliterative poem, The Fall of Arthur, reflecting on the death of Arthur, or telling a story of the death of Arthur in a relatively non-magical tone, where Arthur is portrayed primarily as this British hero fighting the last-ditch battle against the Saxons, and the elements of Guinevere and Mordred's betrayal are there, and Lancelot is in there. He didn't finish it. He actually ended up apparently setting it aside to finish up a little children's book he was working on, known as The Hobbit, which kind of got him permanently sidetracked. He did think about going back to it, and people who had reviewed his work, he got quite a ways into it, actually thought it quite good, although they found it ironic that he's writing in the kind of Anglo-Saxon alliterative style of verse and kind of the language of the enemy about Arthur, although he's actually following in a Arthurian tradition there, Arthurian English tradition, with the alliterative poems about the mort d'Arthur or the death of Arthur. So Arthur is there in the background for Tolkien. He obviously knows it. He didn't choose to go there, partly because of the success of The Hobbit and the desire for more stories about The Hobbit. But you can see reflections of Arthur in Tolkien as well. You've got, obviously, the return of the king, Aragorn coming back to claim his throne. Obviously, that's a key part of the Arthurian legend, the notion that Arthur will return. He also states in a letter that he had given Frodo and Bilbo an Arthurian ending, in that the elves summon the ringbearers to the west, and then, of course, they go into the west to be healed of their burden, of their wound, which has given them immortality. So there's definitely echoes of Arthur in Tolkien's work, including, I think most significantly, the strong association of fantasy, as it became really defined by Tolkien, with both the medieval age and or the dark age, I suppose, which would be more Arthur's time. But of course, Arthur is portrayed primarily as being a medieval king. And of course, the whole tradition of nobility, chivalric, heroic endeavor, which permeates the Arthurian legend. Lewis gets even more directly involved in Arthur. He actually has Merlin return in That Hideous Strength, the third book of his science fiction trilogy. And Ransom, his main character of the trilogy, is portrayed as kind of almost the return of Arthur, if you will. Perhaps along the lines of John the Baptist being Elijah. So that's pretty direct there in That Hideous Strength. He also directly refers to the legend in The Voyage of the Dawn Treader, my inspiration for this talk in some respects. Lewis says in The Voyage of the Dawn Treader, when the Pevensey children had returned to Narnia last time for their second visit in Prince Caspian, it was for the Narnians as if King Arthur came back to Britain, as some people say he will. And I say the sooner the better. Lewis again references this notion of Arthur's returning, he figures the world is in terrible shape and we really need Arthur to come back. There's actually what I think is an even more interesting and much more subtle reference in Prince Caspian. And to get this, I need to read a bit from Christopher Tolkien's edition of The Fall of Arthur, some of his notes. He says, "The association of Arthur's grave with Glastonbury can therefore be described briefly. The earliest written record is found in a work of the Welsh antiquary Geraldus Cambrensis, or Gerald of Wales, written near the end of the 12th century. After observing that the fantastical tales told of Arthur's body, as it had been borne to a region far away by spirits and was not subject to death, he said that in our days, Arthur's body had in fact been found. This is about 1191, by the monks of the Abbey of Glastonbury, buried deep in the ground in a hollowed oak in the graveyard. A leaden cross was fixed to the underside of a stone beneath the coffin in such a way that the inscription on the cross was concealed. This inscription, which Giraldus himself had seen, declared that buried there was the renowned King Arthur, together with Guinevere in Insula Avalonia, in the island of Avalonia. He records also the curious detail that beside the bones of Arthur, which were of huge size, and of Guinevere, was a perfectly preserved tress of her golden hair, but that when it was touched by one of the monks, it instantly fell to dust. In the same passage, Giraldus said that what was now called Glastonia was anciently called Insula Avalonia. This name, he explained, arose because the place was virtually an island, entirely surrounded by marshes, whence it was called Britannis, in the British, in other words, Celtic language, Innis Avalon, meaning, he said, Insula Palmifera, island of apples, aval being the British word for apple, for apple trees were once abundant there. He adds also that Morganus, who was a noble lady akin to King Arthur and ruler of that region, took him after the Battle of Camelon to the island which is now called Glastonia for the healing of his wounds. So, extended quote there, I relate the whole thing mostly because it's of interest to anybody who's interested in whether or not Arthur was a historical figure. There's another little bit of evidence. But the really interesting little detail here is that Avalon, the Isle of Avalon, the place that Arthur is taken to heal, means the Island of Apples. And because there were lots of apple trees there, apparently. And apparently it was not really an island. It was more of a peninsula, if you will, going out into a kind of a marshy region. And this really puts me in mind of this passage from Prince Caspian. The Pevensey children have just come back, as he describes in The Voyage of the Dawn Treader, in that quote where he references King Arthur. Don't you remember planting the orchard outside the north gate of Caerparvel? They've just found a bunch of apple trees here. The greatest of all the wood people, Pomona herself, came to put good spells on it. And the response is, but Caerparvel wasn't on an island. Yes, but it was a, what do you call it, a peninsula? Jolly near an island. Couldn't it have been made an island since our time? Somebody has dug a channel. St. Peter, this is a conversation between Peter and Edmund in Prince Caspian. So the royal residence of the Pevensey children in Narnia is essentially Avalon. it's an island, at least it becomes an island in Prince Caspian and is a peninsula in their own day. And they plant lots of apple trees there, such that the apple trees actually take over the place. And then, of course, this return is referenced by C.S. Lewis in The Voyage of the Dawn Treader in conjunction with The Return of Arthur. So very interesting that they've got these echoes of Arthur here in the Narnian Chronicles. It's also interesting to me that neither Lewis nor Tolkien, as I say, fathers of modern fantasy though they are, went down the road of actually finishing and publishing anything that's fully Arthurian. Lewis references the Arthurian legend in both the Narnian Chronicles and in more extensively in That Hideous Strength. Tolkien obviously has echoes of it in his own work, but neither of them return to that. And I wonder, this is just me speculating now here, but I've said before that I think Lewis and Tolkien both publicly eschew allegory. They specifically say their works are not allegorical because of the boogeyman of Bunyan. Bunyan's Pilgrim's Progress is this really famous but terribly simplistic allegory that Lewis and Tolkien, who were literary scholars who knew really good allegory, because Lewis actually really loved the Fairy Queen, which is a dark conceit, an extended allegory, they knew that there were at least allegorical elements in their books, but they didn't want people making the kind of simplistic one-to-one correspondences that people tend to do when they've, you know, read a little bit of allegory like John Bunyan and think they know, the ring represents the atomic bomb. So they both were very clear that it was not allegory. I think partly in response to this popular idea of oversimplification of allegory due to John Bunyan. I wonder whether they similarly avoid returning to Arthur because of the triumph of Tennyson. That, as I've said, Tennyson's Idylls of the King are the most powerfully Christian portrayal of Arthur that I'm aware of. So it's quite possible that they felt that, you know, this has really been done. There's not much more new to say here. As I say, this is speculation, and it is a little bit undermined by the fact that Tolkien was actually trying to write an extended Arthurian alliterative poem. Of course, he didn't finish it. But it's very interesting that Arthur is, an Arthurian legend is very clearly a significant influence on both Lewis and Tolkien, who, as I say, kind of establish the pattern for modern fantasy. And they do make use of some of the patterns that we see in Arthurian legend. Arthurian legend, and more specifically the death of Arthur, have had a huge influence on me as well. As a guy, I was, of course, interested in fighting and battles and all those sorts of things. But I recognized I wasn't going to be the biggest or the strongest or the best. Those weren't my strengths. But on the other hand, this notion of fighting for a great ideal, this notion of rallying people to a cause, was actually pretty important to me. And it felt like something that I possibly could do. And it's interesting to me, looking back now, you know, on the Arthurian legend, Arthur is a good knight. He's a good fighter, but he's not the best. You know, if anyone, Lancelot's the best. Gawain as well is, you know, bigger and stronger. So his role is primarily that of a leader. He leads by example. He is himself a knight. But he's not necessarily the biggest and the best. So I guess that may well have appealed to me. Even more significantly, though, I think, the notion of fighting for a cause that is worth dying for, something greater than oneself, and doing so in a manner that is honorable and without fault. This, to me, was highly inspirational. And still is to this day. I think it's something worth gleaning from the Arthurian legend. And of course it is tied directly into the death of Arthur. Arthur is willing to go up against whatever it is, whatever those insurmountable odds are that are between him and the ultimate objective, whether that be the safety of his people, whether that be the honor of his royal knights or of his queen. He's always willing to sacrifice himself for the other, for the greater good, for the cause. And this is something that I think is hugely valuable. You know, I'm not saying that I have always lived up to this ideal, but I saw this, particularly in my father, who was willing to take on causes that seemed doomed to fail, but were worth fighting for. There's like that quote, I believe it's only in the movies actually, but it's a great quote where Sam says, "There's good in the world, Mr. Frodo, and it's worth fighting for." That to me is deeply Arthurian. And no less a figure than John Steinbeck wrote about this sensibility. He says, "The Western world and its so-called culture have invented very few things." He writes this in 1953. "But there is one thing that we invented and for which there is no counterpart in the East, and that is gallantry. It means that a person all alone will take on odds that by their very natures are insurmountable, will attack enemies which are unbeatable. And the crazy thing is that we win often enough to make it a workable thing. And also, this same gallantry gives a dignity to the individual that nothing else ever has." So Steinbeck was actually quite taken with Arthurian legend. He loved his Caxton edition of Le Morte d'Arthur, Malory's Morte d'Arthur. And when he found out about the Winchester manuscript, he actually spent the last few years of his life working on a translation of the Winchester manuscript of Malory's Le Morte d'Arthur, which he didn't actually finish. He got quite a ways through it. But it's an interesting observation here that this notion of gallantry, I'm not 100% convinced that it's unique to the West, but it certainly is strongly embraced by Western culture. And it's one of the nobler aspects of Western culture that I think is worth celebrating, is worth baptizing, so to speak. We all face death. There's simply no avoiding it. And the great Shakespearean play, Hamlet, possibly his greatest play, Hamlet's struggle is precisely with death. I mean, the death of his father and the power that his uncle, the usurper, has over him. And for much of the play, he's struggling to get out from under his uncle's power, partly by feigning madness, an attempt to gain control of his own destiny using his own approach. And there's this incident in Hamlet, which is kind of seemingly very random, but actually pretty significantly randomly, is when Hamlet is being taken by his friends Rosencrantz and Guildenstern to England, where Rosencrantz and Guildenstern have letters that he is to be beheaded. There's this incident where a pirate ship comes. Hamlet swings over to engage the pirates, and then the ships are separated, and the pirates then take him back to Denmark. And it's, as I say, seemingly this random incident, but Hamlet draws from it a really important lesson. He says, "Our indiscretion sometimes serves us well when our deep plots do pall. And that should teach us that there's a divinity that shapes our ends, rough hew them how we will." And he takes this lesson that he learns from the seemingly random incident with the pirates, which takes him back to Denmark. And he's a changed man when he comes back. He knows he's no longer feigning madness. He is kind of just taking things as they come, because he sees that there's a divinity that shapes our ends, rough hew them as how we will. And so that when the offer of the duel comes up, which of course is where he meets his end, he embraces it. And when his friend Horatio tells him, you know, "Wait a sec, this could be a trap," he says, "Not a whit. We defy augury. There's a special providence in the fall of a sparrow. If it be now, 'tis not to come. If it be not to come, it will be now. If it be not now, yet it will come. The readiness is all." And that last line, "the readiness is all," really sums up for me how we should be facing our death. First of all, in the background for the Christian, there is an understanding that there is a divinity that shapes our ends, rough hew them how we will. We have some rough control over our lives, but, you know, in the end, we don't have a lot of control. How do we respond to that? Well, we respond to that as Christians, as seeing the hand of God in that. And then we embrace that and accept that. And as we do that, our job is not to avoid death, but to be ready for it, so that when it comes, we are prepared to meet it with honor, with dignity, with gallantry, and in a way that is uncompromisingly committed to honor, to the truth, and to all that is good in humanity. We need to appropriate for ourselves the death of Arthur. That we, as we face death, which we must do, as we face our own mortality, which we have to do, we do so with honor, with integrity, and with dignity, that understanding that God is at work in all things for our good, as we love him and are the called according to his purpose. So, as a podcast, as a series of episodes on the deaths of Arthur, this beginning of the Geek Orthodox podcast has been an experiment, an adventure, if you will. It's one that has probably been marred at times by wanderings through the Forest Perilous, and has brought me sometimes into encounters with that which has been enchanted and beautiful. I'm not 100% sure how successful it's been as a podcast, or even as launching what I hope will be my larger Geek Orthodox podcast. But it's been, I think, for me, a worthwhile exploration to begin with the historical Arthur, the roots of the Arthurian legend, and moving through the literary beginnings of the literary Arthur, and then into the developments, the really great developments of that legend under Malory and Tennyson, and beyond with some of the influences on my heroes Lewis and Tolkien, and on myself. There's actually one other way in which this really deeply affects me. My very first short story was about a descendant of Arthur who is defeated in a kind of glorious last stand at Old Sarum Castle near Stonehenge by William the Conqueror, and is then wiped out from the historical record. Not a terribly great story by any stretch of the imagination, but this really did have a deep impact on me as a youth. And that's, I think, is a good starting point, a good jumping off point for considering this geek culture that embraces insult, that celebrates and dives into things in detail, geeking out about stuff, and which needs to be baptized. Not all of this is good stuff. Some of it's good, some of it's bad. It's just as with all cultures. And so as I continue this exploration, hopefully continuing this podcast, I don't think I'll probably go into quite as much detail as I have in the past. I do think I will return to Arthur. There's lots more to be said. I mean, after all, I only got to Tennyson. I didn't cover any of the modern adaptations. That was partly deliberate. I'm not a huge fan of a lot of the modern interpretations. But I also want to go off in a whole bunch of other different directions. And so, as I say, this has been a fun adventure, a wandering, so to speak. And I hope that you've enjoyed it and that you'll continue to join me as I wander into other aspects of the culture which I grew up with, which I embraced, and which really has shaped in so many different ways the modern world in which we now find ourselves. God bless. I look forward to chatting with you in future episodes.